EM, as you know, as odd as it sounds, is really just a way to calm the mind down, just to relax the mind and focus on a mantra, a word that has holy origins in India. I wasn't really interested in the spiritual aspect, but I did read an article that said meditation, according to some tests at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, that meditation seemed to calm people down. It was a stress reliever. So I thought, okay, sign me up. So I went. At that time, you had to bring an apple and $35. And they gave you the word. They had a whole dictionary of them at $35. No, I'm just joking about that. Anyway, and some support and some ways to do it and opportunities to, you know, have other seminars and other practice. But so I was quite diligent. 20 minutes in the morning, 20 minutes at night, I would sit quietly reflecting on my mantra. And I noticed that my mantra would come when my breath went in and go when my breath went out. I would come and go at the rising and the falling of the breath. So I was saying this mantra when the breath rose and when the breath fell. So, and it was so simple. I thought, this is great. Does it really work? Well, I noticed, you know, I can only speak for myself, but I found myself just calming down, chilling out, not getting so worried about the games, playing better basketball. I was at that time high school level basketball player. I was being looked at by a few universities, but I wasn't, you know, I wasn't Michael Jordan in the making, that's for sure. But my game got better, which is really what I wanted. And I ended up, you know, getting essentially my university education paid for because I played basketball as a result of that, which thrilled me to no end because I really liked basketball. That was my, you know, I just really dug it. You can't picture more fun than being given money and a room at a university and free meals and a basketball every day to play with. And they'd fly you around to various places, you know, and gave you free shoes. I couldn't do better than that. But I also noticed a couple of other byproducts, which, you know, were helpful. I noticed that I could study better. I could do all-nighters better, more productively. I could, you know, I could cram better. But I could also seem to be able to retain more during my studies in just listening in the lectures and listening in school. So my marks improved, and I wasn't doing anything different. I wasn't this, you know, a particularly whiz kid student, but I was just the studies were going better. And another thing I noticed too was I didn't seem to get stressed out. When things would go wrong, little crisis or major crisis would go wrong, I didn't seem to, you know, I didn't, I just looked at what had to be done and did it, as opposed to a group of people around who were spinning. So I found that interesting. It was a nice thing to have happen, but it was sort of a byproduct. Well, lo and behold, things came, things went. I didn't get drafted into the NBA, so my career as a basketball player ended on the last buzzer of the last game of my senior year. But I had enjoyed myself. I went out into the business world and got involved in the financial industry. Traveled to England, did some business there. And, you know, kind of kept meditating, just kept meditating. And I seemed to have a balance that, you know, I couldn't find out when I didn't meditate. I could know when I did. If I missed a few days meditating, things would get a little, you know, kind of a little stressy, a little anxiety would arise. And when I did meditate, I just felt kind of mellow, cool, able to face things. Then I read a book, one of those self-help books that said, to be balanced in life, you have to have your social life in order, your emotional life in order, your financial life in order, and your spiritual life in order. And I didn't know what I didn't have a spiritual life, really. Now, I grew up, as a Protestant in Canada, and, sang in the choir at Sunday school and played hockey in the inter-church league. But I didn't really, I wasn't really a high-powered, Protestant. But I thought I'd better, take a look and see what was out there, just check around. So I went looking at a variety of religions, places that I considered a spiritual practice. And I examined Christianity thoroughly, Hinduism, Buddhism, Mormonism. I looked at the Unitarian Church. I looked around. And I was just kind of walking around with my feelers out to see what would work. Well, just to cut a long story short, or I'll be here all night telling you about everything in my life, I essentially found the teachings of the Buddha to be sort of undeniable. I couldn't find a fault with them. I couldn't find anything wrong. And not that I could find things wrong with the other paths I mentioned, but this just seemed to be very, very clear. What attracted to me were the basic core teachings. The one that kind of was very interesting, kind of caught my fancy first, was the teachings on the laws of cause and effect. It's called karma. And essentially it means that when an action is instituted, when you choose an action, there will be a result from it. Now, this is pretty, obvious to science people here because, you turn the Bunsen burner on, the test tube will heat and the reaction will occur. You combine sodium and chloride, you're going to get salt. There's a cause and effect in science that's pretty obvious. Physics has it. But the teachings around the Buddha spoke of were simply that there is cause and effect intertwined in all parts of our life, all aspects of our life. So this means that if you do some wholesome activities, there will be wholesome effects. If you do unwholesome things, stealing, lying, cheating, harming people, killing, there will be unwholesome effects. Now, they will arise very close to the activity that you involve yourself in or distantly from the activity. But there was no way that you could escape the effects of the causes you chose to institute. So in other words, once you chose the action, the result was going to follow sometime, and it was kind of inescapable. So what appealed to me about that was it just made logical sense that I was kind of responsible, because I'd seen in the past when I'd done kind of nasty things to people, I inevitably suffered somewhere. And when I was generally nice, cordial to people, I was treated with respect and cordiality. So I could kind of get that. It made sense to me. Another thing that made sense to me, what it became very clear was the challenge in life at that point, was to be able to have a clear enough mind that could actually understand what actions were going to be beneficial to me and to others, and what actions were going to be harmful to me and to others. So that really was kind of interesting to me, that there'd be a causality that and a way of developing a mind that could discern what was going to be a positive action and beneficial to everybody and myself, and what was going to be harmful to myself and to others. Well, the practice of meditation, lo and behold, was touted as the way to develop a mind that was clear. One of the other core teachings of the Buddha that mightily impressed me was he had very simple, do good, do only that which is good, and support that which is good. Don't do harmful harm or evil, and try to dissemble. Do not support that which is evil. And this third the third teaching of the Buddha was, purify your mind. Purify your mind. Now, purifying the mind really means not giving those negative emotions such as greed, anger, fear, any sway, not reacting based on those emotions. So that when you made a choice to do something, it was with a fairly clear mind, so that the action you chose would not cause harm to you or others, because it's unwholesome to harm others. It's unwholesome. It will come back and harm you eventually. It's helpful, useful to be kind, generous, sharing with others. It will inevitably come back to you. Okay? So developing the mind that could discern what choices were going to be good, what choices weren't going to be good in the short and the long run, really appealed to me. Really appealed to me. And it wasn't too much of a stretch, because meditation was the way, and the teachings of the Buddha, which involved heavy doses of meditation, fit right in. And the more I practiced, the more I saw that this was true by my own experience. Another thing that drew me to Buddhism, which I kind of liked, was a little story, the Buddha, it's a sutta, it's called, one of the suttas, the teachings of the Buddha. It's like one of the parables of Jesus. And the Buddha was in a town once called Kalama. And Kalama was a town that was well visited by wandering ascetics, wandering teachers. And as the Buddha came into the town square, if you will, and was seated respectfully, everyone in the town came out and said, bowed respectfully to the Buddha, and then asked this question. I'm going to paraphrase it in English idiom, because in Pali it comes a little stilted, but they said, essentially, Lord Buddha, we get a lot of you folks coming to our town, a lot of itinerant teachers saying that they have the way, and theirs is the best way, the final way, the only way. Please tell us how we can tell who is telling us the truth and who isn't. How do we tell the true way? And the Buddha said, it's easy. He said, first of all, don't believe any teacher, including me, based on reputation, custom, tradition, charisma, or any other public relation gizmos that they might have going. That wasn't in the Pali text, but we can say it is, okay? Marketing doesn't count as far as the Buddha was concerned, including himself. He included himself in that group of teachers. They said, then how can we tell? If the doctrine, said the Buddha, propounds non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. In other words, it teaches you how to avoid greed, anger, and delusion. It's a good doctrine. If a reasonable being would see that as a good doctrine, then it is a good doctrine. If the teaching has any component which leads to greed, anger, or delusion, stupidity, ignorance, it is false. It is false. So he said, please, he coined the Pali phrase ehipasiko, which means come, look, and investigate and decide for yourself. Okay? No marketing. Just come, take a look, If it works for you, good. If it doesn't, so be it. At least examine. When I ran into that teaching, it impressed me because we're from North America. We're getting pitched all the time, aren't we? Do this, come here, do that, buy this, sell, blah, 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 blah. I was up to my eyeballs in marketing. And it was just anybody who says, come and take a look, come and examine, I'm interested. And I did, and I found it to be very helpful in my particular life. What I consider myself now is a meditation teacher. I had the fortune to meet one of the finest meditation teachers alive today, a fellow by the name of Chenmye Syato, Syato Ujjanika. He's a very gentle, respectful monk who I studied and practiced with for a number of years while I was still working in Vancouver. I would take 3 months off from my job as a financial planner, and I would go and do meditation with him. Eventually, in due course, after I'd been doing 3 months, 3 months, 3 months, and then eventually 6 months, he invited me to come and teach with him. So that's essentially what I did. I had a good job. I had a good life when I lived in Vancouver. I was a financial planner. I had some very good clients that I enjoyed. I had a well-paid hobby. You may know that Vancouver has a lot of film industry there. I was an actor, professional actor, getting paid. It was a hobby. You won't recognize me in anything. I was in X-Files. I did do some stuff like that, mainly day jobs. I would walk in and usher the star to his table and said, may I get you a glass of water, for which they'd pay me $2,000. And I'd have a lot of fun. It was a hobby. And I did stage and had fun, but I did acting. So I had a very good life. But I was also drawn to, I saw teaching meditation as a very valuable tool in this particular era we have to be in, where there's a lot of confusion, a lot of chaos going on. I thought it would be useful to help people find a way to relieve stress, focus their minds, and make clear choices in their life. So essentially, even though I wear funny clothes compared to the Westerners, I still consider myself essentially just a meditation teacher here to help people clear their minds up. So that's my story, really. As close as we can get to the present moment. So that's how I ended up in robes. That's how I ended up learning about meditation. It all started probably, any of you who are around 16 or 17, that's when I started to look into meditation. And that was a lot of years ago. But anyway, I'm here in front of you now. So do you have any questions or anything you'd like to ask me? Right here, right up, first one, yes.
So you were in
X-Files? Yep. Yes, I was. I was afraid. Yes, I was. Okay, the episode was the guy that had the tattoo on his arm that kept telling him to kill everybody. And I was the lawyer defending the wife of this guy. And that's a good question. You love X-Files. Well, frankly, it was a brilliant show, Frank. It really was a good show, well done, and started off very well. So I was in there, and I came close on a couple of other episodes, but that was the one. And I worked for the same producer, Harsh Realm and Millennium. I did other stuff for this guy, Chris Carter. Really, really nice guy. Really, actually quite a cool guy. So he hired me to do other stuff in other equally small parts in other things. But I got to meet everybody and, I tried to keep my ego under control. I'm going to pick up a story. I just want to tell you a little story about that's sort of like what you just did. When I was in Malaysia, there was a young, I was teaching a meditation group. And there was the youngest guy in the group was a 16-year-old who had a sister who was 8. And he was very happy to have a meditation teacher. And he was a young guy that was, you know, giving it his all. And his sister asked the mother if I could be her meditation teacher. And she said, well, you'll have to ask him directly. So she came to me, and she was a young 8-year-old girl interested in meditation. She said that she'd been meditating on her own. And I said, so tell me about your story. What did you... She said, well, I see light a lot. I see light coming, and I stick around my rising and my abdomen. Breathing is very easy for me. And then all of a sudden, there'd be flashes of light. And I said, how long do you meditate? She says, about 6 minutes a day, and it helps me. And whenever I feel stressed, I do it. And I said, good, good, good. So I was telling her, I gave her a couple of little techniques she could try, and she was very appreciative, and she said... And I told her, I had told her that I played basketball in university, and my team was called the X-Men. They were it was a Catholic school, Francis Xavier, and X-Men were the name of our thing. She said, is that like the cartoons? I said, no. We weren't. She said, were you a superhero? I said, no. just a basketball player. So we talked and talked and talked, and she's sitting here, and the parents are sitting approximately where you two are, except moved together. And I can see her here, and I can see the parents there. I got a split screen happening. So I can see their reactions of pride and happiness, and their reactions of, what's she going to do next? And I can see her never took her eyes off me, never looked away from my eyes, big brown eyes looking at me intently. And she said, I said, is there anything else? She said, yeah. Now I have one more question, Bhante. Bhante is what they call monks in Asia. One more question. I said, yeah. I said, go ahead, anything. And the parents are sitting there wondering. And by now I'm a little worried too, because, you know, a profound question from an 8-year-old can stump anybody, can just make a monk look stupid. And that's what I was a little worried about. I was doing good. You know, this was a good interview, and I was afraid we got one of these blockbuster questions that I'd have to go read a book to answer. I said, what's the question? She said, well, Bhante, pause. And I'm thinking, I'm starting to sweat a little. She finally just said, blurted it out. She said, so when you played basketball, did you have as much hang time as Michael Jordan? I said, no. Michael Jordan was the Buddha of basketball. I was just an average monk. She said, oh, okay. Thank you. I said, anything else? She said, no, that's all I need to know. So yeah, I was on X-Files, and I didn't have as large a role as David Duchovny. Didn't make as much money as him either, or have any hang time around him. Yeah, so any other questions? Who went up first? Go with you first. And you're next. Yeah, go. Good question. Very simple. The fellow that invited me to travel with him and essentially apprentice me as a teacher is a monk. So I had to be a monk. Now, I had been a monk, because when I went in 94, I first started to meditate. I would monk up. I would, oops. I don't mean to be colloquial. That's what we called it. The group of us would go and become monks. We called it monking up, okay? Don't tell Seattle that, okay? Anyway, I would become a monk for 3 months, 4 months. I found practicing in the robes just enhanced the meditation for some reason. So I'd been used to going on alms rounds with a big bowl like this for my food and wearing the robes. So it wasn't that much of a segue from, you know, silk ties to robes. Yeah, so that's the reason. Just so I could travel with him and be more than just a copy, more than just an attendant. I wanted to be able to teach. And that was sort of the only way. Yeah, I live nowhere, but I'm an itinerant. The place I spend the most time is in Thailand at a monastery, at a meditation center that this particular monk founded south of Bangkok, a town called Nakhonbathom. The rest of the time I travel around primarily with this monk, assisting him, and often will be invited to give my own retreats from time to time. So that's essentially, that's the what I do. So I'm just a wandering monk, really. You're next, and then, wow. Okay, you got your hand up first, for sure. Yeah. Give up my lay life? Yeah, right? Let me just think. It wasn't that hard, but I do notice the training principles. I do notice that. Having said that, you know, I had a very wild and rich life before I was a monk. I did a lot of things that I can't talk about here, but I didn't break the law, okay? But I just did a lot of interesting things, let's leave it at that, okay? And so I saw a lot of, you know, I had a lot of, you know, things and life experiences that I'd seen the end of, that I'd seen. They'd come and they were fun, and then they'd leave me kind of with a broken heart or a skinned knee or depressed or hungover or, you know, or aching or something or something or something. I've lived a good life. So I thought it might be, you know, and having been a monk for a number of times prior to that, I thought it would be a very interesting thing to do, and it is, because, you know, I get to live a simpler life without having all the sort of entanglements that I left behind. Living in the real world has a lot of hooks and barbs and scrapes and stuff that I feel better off without. Okay. But, you know, I'm not anti anything in lay life. I think, you know, dive in and have a good time. But be aware of what the consequences of your good times are. Are you hurting people? You know, watch that. I wasn't always so... the reason I understood this law of consequence was cause and effect was I had done some nasty things to people, and I got stung badly when the boomerang came back to me. So I knew, and I'd been a somewhat generous fellow as well, so I saw that as well. So I had a lot of experience about, you know, causality. So yeah, it's a bit of a challenge, but, you know, not that much. Okay, wait. Back at the back. And then you, and then over here we'll go. Okay. Red shirt, front. Okay, go ahead. The thing. Go ahead. Spit it out. I don't have as much hang. I don't have sex, that's true. Do I crave? Yeah. Okay, that's a personal question, but but I said I'd answer any question when I came here. In truth, 2 years into this as a full-timer, I get a little hungry in the evening sometime. We have two meals in the morning, early morning and midday. I get hungry if the food that's been offered isn't ample or I haven't eaten much. But what I get to see about that is I'm not as scrawny, I haven't lost weight. I'm healthy, I'm strong, my mind is clear, my mind is bright. The hunger I get in the evening is more or less just habitual eating. You're just kind of putting food in my mouth. And when I was a layman, I'd only really have a bowl of soup at night anyway. So I begin to see around that one, just the food is important and the food we get offered is very good, very wholesome, almost all the time. But I can see that there were issues around food for me. I would gobble a lot of peanut butter sandwiches down and chips and stuff just because I was feeling lonely or I just something to do with my hands and my mouth, really. And I enjoyed the feeling of food falling down my gut. But I haven't really missed any of the other stuff I gave up. As I said, I had a wild life. And it's kind of nice to be in a place where this wildness doesn't rip me apart like it used to from time to time. So I would say there's not very much that I miss. Now, I've done a lot of things that I enjoyed and saw their benefits and saw their end. And this is just another way of being that I find very peaceful, very calm. So I guess the closest I could come is sometimes I get hungry in the evening. That's the 24/7. No, I never go in regular clothes, but when I'm in my room private, I take it all off and get into bed and maybe just wrap a robe around me. But we have to keep the robes by our Vinaya sort of 3 feet from us. So the robes are always close to me. But I find the robes very efficient in Thailand because they absorb, they're cotton. They're very light, they're cool. They don't stick to me. They're just very comfortable. This is actually a very comfortable thing to wear in Asia. But we have to keep our robes close or on us most of the time. But whenever I'm out in public, yes, I do wear my robes. And sometimes when I'm around in a cold climate, I'll put snow boots on and a snow jacket on, but essentially just keep my robes on and keep warm. That's essentially what I do. Okay? Now, who was next? You? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I knew. Tell me, 4, 5, depends on what tradition. They essentially mean the Buddha was either teaching, meditating, or stopping conflicts between some of his warring cousins. So some of these Buddhas reflect the various postures of stopping, meditating, instructing, or touching the ground and saying, I'm not going to get up until I get this right. So they all have a meaning, and they all have a Pali name, which doesn't matter here. But yes, they do have different meanings, 3 of which I've just given you, and there's a couple of others too. Okay. Okay. In our tradition, it isn't. You're talking about the Indian tradition where cows are viewed as manifestations of the gods descended to. Now, again, I'm not a Hindu, so I don't know this. I just know that they consider them a sacred animal that is a manifestation of the divinity, and therefore you don't kill divinity. In our tradition, in the Theravadan Burmese tradition, all life is sacred. Okay, we as monks do not kill anything to the best of our ability, and deliberately do we kill. So we recognize all life to be sacred and respectful, simply because the Buddhists believe that various life forms move across various planes of existence. The two realms that exist on this plane are the animal realm and the human realm, and it's possible for ne'er-do-well humans in this tradition or in this concept to slip down and become a snake, and loyal puppy dogs to perhaps arise in the human realm and enjoy the benefits of being human. So we don't kill anything as monks. Now, not all monks are vegetarian either. They eat meat, but they will not eat meat that has been specifically killed for them. So if I go to a donor's health and they say, "We had a chicken this morning and we killed it for you," I won't eat it. But if they went to the market and bought it and offered it, I would eat it because it's their gift to me. Okay? So that it's different tradition you're talking about. We respect all life. Now, I was going to go over here. Okay, who's first over there? Him? And then 1, 2, 3? Is that okay? Yeah. And then you're there? So you're number 4, and who's over here? Anybody else? Okay, well, you're? Okay, I got to come across. Okay, so I'll go this way. Okay. By the way, I speak English because I'm Canadian. And when I was auditioning for American films, I had to say "house about sorry." I couldn't say "house about sorry," or they wouldn't hire me. I also speak French because I'm Canadian. I am Canadian. Anyway, sorry, I couldn't resist. Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm. Right. And you know what? Some are. Yes, some are. And there are. So the question is, just frame it for me a little. Yeah. Mm. Versus avoiding, yeah. That's a Dhamma talk, because what you're saying is, if I start to put words in your mouth, raise your hand and say, "I don't mean that," and just keep it. But it's am I essentially running away from the world, or is the only way out of this world to run away from it? Am I copping out, or is essentially that what you're saying? Like, am I making choices that are avoiding the suffering or facing the suffering? Okay, is that a good okay? Well, do you know, I had my share of suffering in as a layman. Okay, and being a monk, the suffering is just a different quality. When you're decked out as a human with a body that's essentially getting older and subject to sickness and death and subject to the crazy mind that we seem to have been given, the suffering is sort of incessant. The difference for me as a monk and a meditator is my attitude towards the arising and passing away of this suffering. The things that come, the things that go, the things that attract me, the things that then disappoint me, the things that leave, the things that make me happy, the things that make me sad. I have an understanding of the impermanence of these things, which just, even as a layman, helped me sit comfortably in the yoke, so to speak, sit in the harness a little more comfortably, because the harness that I'm in is the human body, which is quite limiting and you know, subject to decay, etc., with a mind that is somewhat chaotic. So what this particular practice and this particular lifestyle allowed me to do was to face dead on this essential unsatisfactoriness of life's impermanencies. Things coming and going essentially are always going to disappoint you. You know, the things come, nothing lasts in this life. That's the whole problem, is we try to make impermanent things permanent by clinging to them. You know, we manage our portfolios so that, you know, and then when the market falls, we're sick. We try to cling to our, you know, we hope our wives stay with us and our husbands stay with us. They either die, divorce us, or leave us. Even the 60-year-old marriages, one of the parties is going to die in the other's arms sometime, even a long, long-term relationship. Things come and go, come and go, come and go. So all this stuff that is impermanent, we cling to and try to make permanent. And that attitude causes a great deal of suffering in this world. And the clinging and the acquiring of many things is the root of a lot of destructive qualities in this world. The greed that drives us to hang on to these impermanent things causes us to suffer a lot. And on a global level, on a national level, causes wars to erupt, racism to exist, pride to exist. So essentially, what I've more or less been forced to dive into the suffering rather than run from it. What has happened is I have more or less surfaced on the other side of it, so that I see it from a different point of view now. I'm not trying to avoid anything. Now, part of the problem with a lot of the, quote, New Age that goes on is there's a lot of belief that if you're aloof from something, that you must be awakened. And a lot of people who haven't done thorough investigation into what I'm just talking about, the impermanence of stuff, feel that being aloof or away from it is the way to, you know, to find freedom or happiness, when in fact it's just another way that just will collapse ultimately. Okay, in the world, when, you know, again, in the world that we inhabit, there's a lot of people trying to avoid the suffering by getting drunk, you know, having affairs, having sex, acquiring goods, traveling, taking drugs, you know, overeating. All this is happening to just avoid the pain. I found it very useful to dive in the pool of pain and see what pain is really like. And guess what? I found even suffering is impermanent. So it doesn't even last. But it just keeps arising and passing away. So I would say my quest was more to dive in than to avoid. I found avoiding just like unfulfilling. I tried it, you know. I tried a lot of stuff that kept me away from seeing the true suffering. You know, a lot, I told you my life was wild. So you can, you know, fill in the blank on that one. But I tried a lot of stuff like that, and it didn't work. It just left me feeling more empty. Okay? So I that's a roundabout way, but I think that's, I'll go in circles if I keep going. Okay. It's engagement, seeing the true nature of things, coming out the other side of the engagement, having an understanding that has helped me hold things a little differently. No. good question. There's two types of meditation that exist, period. There's samatha practice, which has a number of ways of practicing. Samatha is the Pali word, which means essentially a practice simply to engage in concentration. Just concentrate the mind. When the mind's concentrated, then it plays basketball better, it studies better, it's focused better, okay? And the negative mental energies like greed, anger, and delusion are pushed aside, and therefore the mind is clear. As soon as you stop meditating, the greed, anger, the fear, the doubt, the blah, 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 the anxiety starts to crowd back in. That's one type. The other type is vipassana practice, which is a practice that allows you to examine all body, mental, and all the activities of the mind and body clearly, so you start to see them in their true nature. And that develops a concentration that begins to do exactly what I was talking about with this other fellow, pierce into the true nature of things and kind of free you up from being so clingy. Okay? I do have a couple of practices I really enjoy. One is metta. I think you just did metta. Metta, loving kindness, offering loving kindness to all beings and all realms and all existences, as well as myself. I find that a very good practice. It calms me down. It when I teach it to students, yogi people, that meditators, they calm down and feel a serenity, a peace that I think is very helpful. And I also teach vipassana. So those are the two that I bias myself towards. But I'm a big fan of anything that gets your mind concentrated, as long as you're not harming other people to do it. So that's what I do. Okay, that's what there is. Beginning, middle, and end. A little Buddhist humor. Like disrobe, sort of? Like, yeah, because that's always, you know, yeah. Wait, the first one was, what were the steps to get in to becoming a monk? It's fairly easy, actually. In this tradition, you simply request permission of the abbot, who then finds a sponsor to buy you robes and bowls and everything you need. And then there's an ordination ceremony where you simply recite the vows, the 227 rules we live by, and they're not all that bad, don't worry. But and you know, endeavor to be a monk. But it's all based on a monk, on the abbot ordaining you. Now, in the Asian tradition, it's kind of a rite of passage for a young man to become a monk, either a full-on monk or what they call a novice monk. It's kind of one of those things. In some countries, you have to enlist in your army. In Burma and Thailand, you enlist in the monastery. And it's really seen as, you know, a rite of passage for a young man to become a monk. And for a young woman to become a nun. It's seen as a sort of a filling of the personality. In other traditions in Sri Lanka, there are some traditions where it takes you 5 years. They kind of test your mettle for 4 or 5 years before you're allowed to ordain. Okay? In my case, I was invited to teach. I consider myself very lucky, but I think I had to go through some hoops that I didn't know I was going through before he invited me to teach. So that was it. So yeah, it was fairly simple. And the first time I did it was in 1994. I took a year off and traveled around Asia. And I had a good retreat with this monk. I said, may I come to Burma for the rains retreat? And he said, yes. And I said, I've always wanted to be a monk. Could I? He said, yes. And so I ordained as a monk quite quickly. And the robes kept falling off, and I kept dropping my bowl. I was just a very slop, funny-looking monk. Okay. The second part was, what do I like most about being a monk now? I like teaching meditation. I like the simplicity of the life. You know, I like the simplicity of the life. And I like the benefit that I see in people's eyes when they get the practice. I enjoy that. Those are two favorite things. And what will I do in the future? Mm. Yeah. And you know, the answer to that is I don't know. And that's all I can say. I don't know. So wait a minute. I think there was someone over here. And oh no, you were next. Good. No, yeah, you were four. Four, five, six, and you're next at seven, coming in. Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Good questions. I don't have children. I have a wife, and we had broken up and gotten back together 2 years before I became a monk full time. She actually supports me. She's my best supporter. When I was invited to travel with Ujjanika, Seattle Ujjanika, she says, "You got to do it. It's just like Einstein inviting a young physicist to come and, you've got to go and see. And if it doesn't work out, you still got your passport. Come on back. And if it does, great. And, you know, if it does for a while and stops working, then come back." So my brother, my mother died a number of years ago. I'm an orphan. My mom died. My brother supports me. And how do I communicate with him? Email. I have an email, and wherever I can, they send me, and we keep in touch. And my wife arranges retreats and helps and comes and sits with me as a student now. So it's all, pretty good. When I'm back in Vancouver, they take me out to lunch, and, we hang around. It's a different relationship now, but it's still a very, she's my best friend, really. So we have a dear Dhammic-based relationship. When we were living together, we meditated every morning together. One of us would poke the other in the ribs and say, "It's time to get up and meditate." And that was the foundation for our relationship, so it was a very good one. I have quite a supportive family. Now, if I get sick, we got human bodies, and they have to, I prefer, if I can heal things with herbal medicines or less invasive techniques like homeopathic or Ayurvedic or naturopathic remedies, I prefer that. But I will, use allopathic, medical diagnostic tools if offered. And that's one thing. They'll always take care of us wherever we go. If I get sick, someone will take me to the hospital. I haven't had any real serious illnesses, but I have had to go to the hospital. I did have, in fact, that's not true. I had dysentery in Burma, and I went to a hospital. The doctor gave me some pills, examined me. I healed up. So no, we're not about, this is just about stewardship. I have a body. It has to be taken care of. I don't have to indulge it and, stuff it full of food and, abuse it, but I have to respect it. That involves taking medical care of it as well. So, and when my time comes, and so be it. I hope I'm mindful when it happens. Yeah, great. Now who? Right. You're no kidding. Which country? America. Yeah, I'm not joking with you. In the world, it's turbulent. Let's get real. Okay. That's a, you know, I'll give you just my opinion, which, you know, I see that truly, you know, all the religions have spoken, every religion has spoken about the problems of greed, the problems of ignorance, the problems of anger, and all religions have a basic tenet that, you know, they will do no harm to others. Every one of them has a golden rule of some kind. Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism certainly does. So at the kernel of every spiritual belief in the world, there is a basic undertaking not to do harm to other beings. And the question, therefore, is why is there a war in Iraq? Why is there problems in the Middle East? Why is there problems in Bosnia? Why is there problems in Afghanistan? Why was there this? Why? And it's simply because of ignorance and simply because of greed and really not focusing on the true nature of your spiritual truth, of the spiritual truth. And the extent to which humankind will effectively purify their mind and live according to the golden rules that are embedded in every one of the spiritual beliefs is the extent to which I think we have an opportunity for salvation, for peace and harmony. But, you know, there's... I'm amazed, and this goes for every politician in any country you want to speak. I'm amazed that the crud rises to the top, not the cream, but the crud. And I'm speaking about my country, any country. The people that seem to end up in politics are not your philosopher kings anymore. They're not the wise ones. They pretend to be, and they sound like they are. But essentially, they're just bucking for re-election most of the time. And this goes for my prime minister in Canada that was just re-elected. He did what it took to get re-elected. And he's not going to follow through on what he did. And essentially, there seems to be a type of person that rises to these levels that it's not about civic duty anymore. It's not about serving your country. You know, I've been reading about the history of your country. And I think your founding fathers really saw the value of, you know, going to Washington or wherever the capital was, putting your time in as a senator, a president, a vice president, and then going back to your community, having served your civic duty. It wasn't about getting reelected 100 years and, you know, making sure everyone in your constituents got a piece of the pie. The founding fathers of this country had a great deal of wisdom. If you look at them, they were wise people, and they were treading new and, you know, kind of, you know, they were the first real democracy, and they were one of the early revolutions. And they, you know, they were treading kind of ice, thin ice. But there was a wisdom in this constitution of yours. Somewhere between then and there and, you know, the early stages of the idealism of new countries, it just became about getting reelected. So I don't know what to say about them. I just, you know, pray that wiser beings end up near the surface, or wiser beings end up with sway in the world. We hold a lot of false heroes as, you know, as our guiding lights. You know, movie stars are heroes in our Western world. And you know, I've met them. I've been on set with them. Many of them are boors. You wouldn't invite them home. They're arrogant. And there's some good ones, too. But, you know, it's all about marketing, you know. And you know, some of the athletes are, you know, they're held up as gods. They're just guys that play sports and get a lot of money to do it. And some of them are really good guys. But many of them are driven by greed for the next big paycheck. But they are the heroes of our societies. They're straw, they're paper tigers, as they say. So the leadership really has to come from within. You've got to take care of your own ballywick, your own morality, your own essential wisdom, of choice, moving forward. That's all you can do. And hope to heck that wisdom prevails in the long term. And, you know, don't re-elect the ones that are silly, ignorant, you know, in all countries. Pardon me? I mean, I'm not here as a political spokesman for anyone particularly, but I'm just saying that the political leaders can wreak amazing havoc. And it's, you know, when their minds aren't clear, we end up in some horrific scenarios when they're just doing something for somebody, for some other agenda that you don't know about. Listen, I'm optimistic because, you know what? I think that just the human goodness, the purity of mind is an essential characteristic of the human. I think what makes CNN and Fox every night is the crap that we do to each other. A Boy Scout helping an old lady across the street isn't going to make the news, but if he mugs her on the way, it'll be front page for 3 days, you know? So, you know, and this is another thing about America being so chastised. You know, I happen to, you know, been a fan of America living north. Your country has been one of the most generous nations in history as far as foreign aid goes, as far as supporting things. Now, some of the foreign aid had a string attached to it, no kidding. But there's been a lot of good done by this country that doesn't make the news. But one Vietnam, okay, and, you know, you're everybody's whipping boy, you know. One arrogant president and everyone hates you. And you're a very strong and powerful and, you know, well-founded country. And, you know, the good sides don't make the news anymore. And that, I think, is we all have to realize that there's an essential good that just won't make the news. And I think, frankly, there's more good than evil. That's my take. It just has to manifest a little strongly, more strongly. So my little contribution is to go around and try to teach people how to keep their minds clear so that they can make choices that are appropriate and helpful for the human race. Really? Thank you. Okay. Amen? Yeah, I'd be happy to, but I'm going to answer some other questions and then we'll do a sit, okay? Who else? Are you there and then there? Okay. Yeah, you, yeah. Or wait. Andre was, okay, sorry, go, yeah. And then you and you. One, two, three. Ask it and we'll see. Mm-mm. I don't care myself, but just for practice, it's considered respectful to the Sangha, which a monk is a member of. The Sangha is the order of monks, to be modestly attired, modestly dressed. Okay, it's just it shows a respect, you know. I used to wear shorts and, you know, all sorts of stuff too. So personally, I don't care. But I think it's good practice because it just shows a respect to the monastics that are in your presence. Yeah, go. You got the floor. No, I didn't. There was no need to. I just left them with my wife, which is maybe donating them in a without a divorce, you know. No, I just let her take care of it. And there's some of the things that it would have been silly to do. There was some tax stuff that would have really been ridiculous to do. So I just let her handle it. Yeah. Good. So. Mm. Yes. Mm. Well, when I'm out, it's yahoo.com has a newspaper in it. And that's my email, okay? And the reason I keep myself somewhat informed is so that I can talk about it reasonably in a practical point of view. My main strength I see as a monk is I was a layman for 49 years. I did meditate in that time. I've been through, I had a life, a good life. And I won't ever know the scriptures, the teachings of the Buddha as in depth as anybody else will. I just haven't got time. I only got another 25 years on this plane, maybe, if I'm lucky. And so my strength as a teacher is being able to relate to people about what we call samsara, which is the place of the realm of the world of forms and appearances where things happen and come and go. I think it's good to be well informed about that. It just makes my, it gives me endless things to talk about in my Dhamma talks. Okay, it's just so rich. I can pull an example out that everyone understands because they saw CNN. And then we can talk about how that applies to the life. So that's really why I do it. Chanmie Seato reads a library of books a year as well, so he's well informed too. It's just, I guess, my nature, in a way. Surprises you though, huh? Well, yeah, but this is, we're in this world too, you know. I mean, yes, it is, it's both. But I have to be able to talk to, the people I talk to are from everywhere. So I have to be able to relate to them and understand what they're doing, what they're talking about. Good. Well, that's really, I think, the only thing I can hope to offer as a monk, because I haven't got time to learn all the Pali scriptures and quote them. So I just have to do this as best I can. Yeah, good. So there was another one here. Were you? Okay, and then you. Okay. Why? Okay, that's a, the Buddha shaved his head before he became enlightenment. Before he became enlightened, it was a symbolic thing to save on hair care products. No. Shaving the head in this particular order I think it had a few reasons. It was a symbol that I'm renouncing the world. In other words, I don't have to go to a barber anymore. Okay, and the Buddha did that prior to his struggle to find enlightenment. Before he went on a series of very small diets of one grain of rice a day, became very thin, but he had shaved his head as an indication. So we do that in respect for him. I will just venture a couple of other things too. I think back at the time of the Buddha, it was better to shave your head so that lice and dirt wouldn't accumulate in it, because there was no adornments allowed. So I think it became a practical thing. From this point of view, it's really just symbolic respect for the Buddha's teaching. And it's cooler in Asia too. Right. Who was next? Yeah, I'll die. Do I know when? No. Well, I'm just, pardon me, what happens after? Afterlife, oh. That's another day-long Dhamma talk, but I'll keep it brief. Okay, when I said 25 years, I'm 50 years old, which, 25, 30 years is about all I got left, more or less. And it could be 40 years, it could be 3 years, it could be 10 minutes. I could get killed on the way back. So I live in a constant state of never knowing whether I'm going to live next day. If I wake up and I'm alive, I proceed accordingly. Okay? So it's a good way to live. It's a good way to live because you never know. And it keeps me in the moment, so I don't waste time. But when it's time for me to die, when it's time for this body to croak, then what'll happen will be everything will stop working, and the blood will stop flowing. And if I'm mindful, I'll see all these processes arising, the mental and physical process, as they die and pass away. And if I'm very mindful, I won't be afraid. I'll just realize it's another passage. In the Buddhist cosmology, depending on the karma, the cause and effect of this lifetime, what you did in this lifetime will inform another lifetime, another existence, will cause another existence to arise. So again, that's, if you buy that rebirth, cosmology, it's very important to choose your actions in this life very appropriately, so that the next life isn't as a spider, for example. Or, you know, like someone like Adolf Hitler didn't make good choices, and he's likely not a human now, because he caused so much suffering. He's probably in a very plane of a very, very deep suffering. In the Buddhist cosmology, there's a number of realms of existence. On the earth plane, we happen to share two. There's the human realm here, which you're familiar with, and then there's the animal realm, which you're also familiar with. These, in the Buddhist cosmology, these are not mutually exclusive. Depending on your activities, you could end up either in one of them. If you really are nasty, and the effects are not pretty, you could end up in lower realms that are invisible to us. The hell realms. There actually is a hell realm in the Buddhist cosmology. It's not permanent, but it's a darn long time of suffering, because you caused a lot of suffering in your human existence, such as someone like Adolf Hitler. On the other flip side of the equation, there are heavenly realms, which those who live very meritorious, very wholesome lives end up. These particular planes of existence are planes of intense pleasure and bliss for millions of earth years. But again, that's not permanent either. The only way to really free yourself is to attain an understanding, a cessation of suffering, to get rid of the attachments, the greed, to uproot those so that you have no desire to return to any plane of suffering. And I mean, again, I'm on the edge of going on for another hour, but I'll just say that's enough. Was there another part of your question?
Yeah,
Well, yeah, I know. Well, it's just a lot of people are having children, and you know, there's a few more spaces left on this planet, so you know, we're having more and more children. In the spiritual context, why did so many people come to this plane at this time? You know, I really don't know. I mean, I have my opinions, but there aren't that many beings here relative to other planes of existence. There are trillions of animals and insects, trillions, and there's only billions of us. In the other lower realms, there are decillions and decillions of beings who are not there. So there's not that many of us relative to what I understand the populations of the other planes, based on only my reading of other texts, not my own consensus, my own census. But there's not a lot of us here. The problem with us, really, is that we're not taking care of what's here now. The 6 billion of us aren't treating each other very well or treating the planet very well, so it's making it a difficult place to live. If we could get along a little better, it would be an easier place. But that's, again, that's all I really know. You and then you. Yes. Mm. Yeah, I know. Well, why don't you just go and try it for a while, like I did, for a few months, and see if it fits. And just tell your family that's just another adventure from your crazy son, your wild.